From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
First this morning, we speak with Dr. Anna Limke, who joins us to discuss her book, Dopamine Nation. She shares how we all can recharge our natural dopamine release by cutting out the unhealthy external search for dopamine. Then, Park City resident Dr. Bob Barali. Dr. Barali is a board-certified emergency physician who transitioned into integrative medicine and is the founder of a business called Journeys. It's a therapy clinic in Salt Lake City specializing in ketamine-assisted therapy. When Dr. Anna Limke's book, Dopamine Nation, came out in 2021, it was immediately a sensation. It seems many people wanted to know, is it correct to pursue the production and release of the happy hormone, dopamine? When is it healthy? And when does it ultimately lead back to pain? Anna Limke's book just came out in paperback, and we're pleased to have her back at KPCW to talk about it. Dr. Limke, welcome to The Mountain Life.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me again.
Can we just start with some definitions? I think we all get confused between some of those brain, are they chemicals? Are they hormones? And what's the difference between dopamine and serotonin?
Well, dopamine and serotonin are both neurotransmitters. These are chemicals that we make in our brain to allow for fine-tuning of our electrical circuits. These electrical circuits are the conduction of electricity through neurons that make us who we are. Hormones are also chemicals in the brain. They also bind to receptors. And I think the distinction between the two is not as important as just understanding that we do have this kind of chemical soup, and these chemicals that we make in our brains rise and fall in accordance with how we interact with our environment. And that the way that we interact with our environment repeatedly over time will either increase or decrease these various chemicals in our brains, either stimulate or extinguish certain electrical circuits that get conducted, in these various loops and networks through our neuronal system.
Dopamine's interesting. It's a little bit like food where you need it, but when you get too much of it, it can lead to bad, unhealthy ends. So the dopamine I feel when I hold a baby, is that's a natural thing. When I experience awe, that's a natural thing. But why do you think in our society now we are searching for unnatural means of dopamine that ultimately end up having an adverse effect?
I think the fundamental problem is a problem of overwhelming overabundance. So we are so overstimulated 24/7 by these highly reinforcing substances and behaviors which release dopamine in the reward pathway that essentially we become numb to the experience of pleasure. And what happens in real time is that our brain gets the message, oh my goodness, this is so much dopamine that I'm getting stimulated by. I need to now downregulate or stop making my own endogenous dopamine. So we essentially go into a chronic dopamine deficit state in response to too much pleasure, too much stimulation. And that means that when we're not being stimulated, we're essentially walking around in a kind of state of chronic depression and chronic anxiety, which we then attribute to an underlying psychiatric disorder, when in fact the real cause is overstimulation and overabundance.
In this society of overstimulation and overabundance, the human brain is so old, and we've been wired to fight off danger and build fire and evolve and farm and do all these things. And so do you think that as the society is becoming easier, if you will, is it a better opportunity for you to challenge yourself and do harder things to help balance those two things out between the pain and the pleasure?
Yeah, so that's, you've hit on exactly the important message and the solution here to this problem of overwhelming overabundance and too much dopamine or the wrong kinds of dopamine. What we've got to do is to essentially insulate ourselves against this world of overabundance, stop imbibing so many highly reinforcing substances is stop engaging in these highly reinforcing behaviors and, in fact, turn and do the opposite and invite friction into our lives, invite hardship into our lives. Because what happens when we do that is we're essentially stimulating the body and the brain to start to make more of our own endogenous dopamine, which is what we need to do. Because remember, what our bodies have done in response to all the intoxicants is to downregulate dopamine production. Whereas if we go on a run or do an ice cold water plunge or clean out the mess underneath our closet, in our closet underneath the stairs, what we're doing now is we're exposing our body to mild to moderate doses of noxious stimuli, which upregulates things like dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, and other feel-good neurotransmitters. So that's the great paradox. In order to be in balance again with our own bodies and with the world in which we live, we need to stop exposing ourselves to these constant stimulants, and we need to intentionally do things that are hard.
So is the intentional doing things of hard, is that part of the solution for the dopamine fasting, or is a dopamine fast kind of just taking a break from life in general, if you will?
So the dopamine fast, what I recommend with the dopamine fast is to identify that drug of choice that we use compulsively in an out of control way in ways that are harmful to ourselves and or others. It's not that we retreat from the world altogether. So it might be a certain app on our phones, a substance that we overindulge in, it might be something even like masturbation, compulsive masturbation, and we eliminate that from our lives for long enough for our brain to start to reset reward pathways. At the same time, if we intentionally do things that are hard, what we can do is restore baseline healthy dopamine firing faster. So for example, patients will say to me, well, if I give up cannabis, what should I do when I'm craving, having that moment of craving? You know, can I eat a cookie or should I watch a Netflix show? And I say to them, well, you could do that. The problem with that is that it probably won't work as well because that's not your drug of choice. Or even if it does, then you're at risk of cross addiction. Paradoxically, something you could do instead is something that's more painful than the pain of withdrawal. Force yourself to go for a run or do 25 sit-ups or read a really hard book or reach out to somebody that you've been meaning to reach out to or apologize to somebody that you owe an apology to. And then what happens is you get your dopamine indirectly, right? Because you've paid for it up front by doing something that's hard. Now, the caveat here is that you don't want to press on the pain side of the balance so hard and so fast that you turn pain into a drug, which can also happen, right? This is things like self-cutting or self-injury, which does release endogenous opioids and endogenous dopamine very quickly, but also exhausts them very quickly. So essentially, if you do that, you know, just a couple of times, it stops working, you need to escalate, and now you've just got a new drug that's called pain. Or for example, compulsive excessive exercise would not be the answer to this. What we're talking is about is regular pulses of mild to moderate painful stimuli in order to reset or re-regulate our dopamine levels. This is the science of hormesis. Hormesis is Greek for to set in motion. And there's a whole interesting animal in human science showing that when we expose the body to mild to moderate noxious stimuli, not too much and not too little, what we get is that we trigger the body to start to upregulate its own healing mechanisms in the form of increasing dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. That's what we're going for, that happy middle of the road level of pain.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Dr. Anna Limke. Her book is called Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Anna, my husband, I'm so proud of him. He's had a 45-day streak on Duolingo.
Oh, great.
And every morning as I'm up making coffee, I hear the little dun-dun, you know, these reward sounds, these bells and whistles. And I'm curious about things that seem as benign as that. I mean, obviously the reward bells and whistles are meant to keep him going, that, right. You know, is it that he doesn't, you know, have intrinsic motivation or what is it? And I'm wondering, you know, how we decipher if we ought to turn off the bells and whistles, that if that can become unhealthy and maybe just search for our own intrinsic motivation?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it gets to the ways in which even things that were previously considered healthy, like learning, have become drugified in some way. I've had readers reach out to me and say, I'm addicted to online chess, right? Who would have thought that chess, this most intellectual of games, could become a drug? But it has now, because of the bells and whistles, because of the rewards, because of the social media, because of the condensed, very fast games. So, you know, we've really hacked this motivational reward pathway. We know how to get people to stay engaged. In the case of your husband, I mean, I think, again, the things to look for are continued compulsive use despite harm to self and or others, which is really the sine qua non of addiction. Softer signs of addiction are things I lie about. So if your husband is telling you, oh, I'm only doing Duolingo 20 minutes a day, but it's really 8 hours a day instead of doing all the other things I'm supposed to be doing, those are the things to look for. I would think, though, it's pretty harmless, especially if the activity, again, is effortful. And it's effortful to learn for the most part, right? So he's learning a language that's not easy, especially midlife and later, but even for younger people, it doesn't sound excessive. So if he's got a little, you know, or a burst of confetti or something like that, you know, it's probably harmless.
Well, darn, I was hoping I would be able to counter with, you really ought to clean the baseboards.
Right.
Okay. That
you
makes
can still
a lot
do
of-
that. You can still bring in the baseboards.
That's right. You tell some crazy stories in the book about people who have gotten addicted in a very unhealthy way to dopamine, some that we don't even want to talk about on radio. But, you know, interesting things that are easier to talk about on radio, like the gentleman who got such a dopamine fix off of shopping online. It was the shopping that got him excited, which I can't even imagine. And then he would order these things. He was so far in debt, but it wasn't actually the opening of the boxes and getting the goods that he had ordered. It was the shopping and ordering. It just makes me think, at what point did that gentleman know he had a problem?
Well, I think for him, when he went into serious financial debt and had several rooms in his house filled with things like mugs and keychains that he didn't even want, was sort of his, you know, he had to get to that point for him. And, you know, in the book, I talk about these extreme examples and also how these people got into recovery. But we're all on that spectrum somewhere, right? I mean, I think we can all, in some ways or another, relate to retail therapy. But also this speaks to drug of choice. For some people, shopping is a complete nightmare. They'd rather, you know, stick needles in their eyes than do it. But for other people, shopping is their drug. And so just recognizing that we all have our drug of choice, that thing that we can get sucked into, and that it can be then very hard to stop or even observe that we've lost some modicum of control. The other thing about addiction, I love this line from my neuroscience colleague, Rob Malenka, who likes to say that the way that in the laboratory they measure addiction in mice is to measure how hard that mouse is willing to work in order to get their drug, how many times they're willing to press the lever, how far in the maze they're willing to go. And I think that's not a bad analogy for our human condition, right? This man was willing to work very, very hard, spend a lot of time finding just the thing that he told himself he needed on Amazon, you know, waiting for it, getting mounting excitement, and then it would come and he would open it. And then as soon as he had opened it, it was this massive dopamine free fall, the kind of, you know, sort of peak and then rapid ebb of any good feelings, as well as feelings of remorse and regret and kind of a surreal quality of wondering, what am I doing? And yet I can't stop it. And yet that dopamine deficit state that followed for him, you know, drove in his instance, which again is the marker of addiction, not to stop that behavior, even though he might have resolved to do so, but actually to try harder to find the perfect keychain or the perfect mug or the perfect pair of sunglasses. So it's noticing that cycle. And then, you know, garnering our resources to try to do a dopamine fast around that behavior, to really committing to not doing that behavior for 4 weeks, 4 weeks being the average amount of time it takes to get out of that compulsive loop and reset healthy reward pathways. What I say to patients is in those first 10 to 14 14 days, you are going to be in a miserable withdrawal, constant intrusive thoughts of why you need to do your drug, anxious, irritable, depressed. But if you can just make it 14 days, really the sun does come out and it gets remarkably easier and those cravings abate and you can sort of move on and also see with more clarity the way that your drug use, and I use that term drug very broadly, obviously, is really impacting your life. And that then gives people the motivation to change their behavior ongoing.
So how do you balance the two between pain and pleasure? Because if your drug of choice is Instagram or alcohol or whatever it is, and you're taking your fast from that, and then you're doing the hard things we discuss, like going for a run or cleaning out your closet or leaning into that new business idea. But as those things become easier and you're progressing in those, you start running 3 miles instead of 2 miles, and then all of a sudden you need to run 25 miles to get your exercise or get that dopamine hit. So how do you balance the two between doing hard things and linking the pain and pleasure together?
Yeah, it's a great question and a very non-trivial question. What makes something addictive is in large part that we control how it changes our feelings in the moment. So part of getting out of the vortex of addiction is to let go of that control, both the illusion of control and also the actual control, and learning how to sit with uncomfortable feelings without changing them. That is really the heart of recovery, if you want to know, not just recovery from addiction, but in my opinion, recovery from life, is learning to not run away from uncomfortable feelings and just to tolerate them, to know that they will end, to trust that something better is coming along. The pressing on the pain side is important, I think, in a world of overwhelming overabundance. We have to intentionally create a lifestyle in which we incorporate hard things every day. We have to get off the couch. We have to go outside and expose ourselves to sunlight. We have to try to walk instead of drive. Those are things that I think we just have to culturally reorient on. But really, the heart of recovery is not using pain per se to, overcome the addiction, but really learning to sit with pain.
The doing hard things is definitely on the trending side of society right now, of all these individuals out there running long distances and just continually doing those cold plunges and those hard challenges every day. So I think my hope is that society is trending in that direction, but it's so hard when we have the use and the ease of all these technological advances. So with the rates of depression and anxiety, suicide increasing all over the world, what should individuals be doing if they are overstimulated with that dopamine of that simple pleasure? How can they seek out help, if you will, for just to get into a better place?
You know, what the book talks about is sort of interventions that people can do on their own, this dopamine fast, self-binding strategies. But obviously, if a person has tried that repeatedly and they've not been successful, or they just don't feel confident that they can do it on their own, seeking out the help of an addiction medicine specialist is very valuable. 12-step interventions for people with severe addiction, things like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. And now we have all kinds of 12-step groups for Overeaters Anonymous, Food Addicts Anonymous, Sexaholics Anonymous, Love and Sex Addicts Anonymous, Video Game Anonymous. I mean, you've got it. These are peer recovery organizations, which the scientific evidence shows, at least for Alcoholics Anonymous, is very effective if people actively participate. And there are lots of interesting ways in which these mutual help organizations work. But I just really urge people, your listeners out there who are struggling with more severe addiction, who have tried on their own to quit or make some intervention, who have been unable to, I just really urge you to overcome the shame, the understandable shame you might feel in attending an AA or an NA or a sex and love addict or pornography addicts anonymous or cannabis anonymous or whatever. And just go check out one of those meetings, because there's something incredibly de-shaming and inspirational and hopeful about sitting with other people who are struggling with the same exact problem, hearing your story out of the mouth of somebody else and realizing, oh, wow, I'm not the only one. And like, my brain is actually okay. And this is just something that human brains and human beings can fall prey to. I'm not alone, and there's hope and there's a way out.
We're speaking with Dr. Anna Lemke about her book, Dopamine Nation. And Anna, you talk a little bit about what goes on in the amygdala of Alex Honnold. And I think the whole nation watched him climb in Yosemite and Free Solo and wondered about people like that. You did not mention it, Adrenaline Junkie Anonymous. And I'm wondering, you know, when you view people that are doing extreme challenges like that, what does it trigger for you in terms of the relation to dopamine?
Well, I think that what I'm trying to get at there is, first of all, why is Alex Honnold able to do that? And what's interesting to me is scientists speculated, oh, he was born with a unique amygdala. He's not, he doesn't have the same fear mechanism. And Honnold himself actually disavowed that theory and said, I don't think it's any of that. I think it's just exposure therapy. I've exposed myself repeatedly to so many cliff faces over so much time that I've essentially neuroadapted to that fear response. And I think he's absolutely right. And that gets at the heart of what is exposure therapy. It's really exposing ourselves in tolerable increments to the things that we're afraid of so that we eventually adapt to them and are no longer afraid, whether you're afraid to, climb up a sheer cliff face or fly in an airplane or, you know, sit next to a spider or talk to people or whatever it is. The remarkable adaptability and flexibility of the brain. And of course, Alex Honnold is a wonderful sort of foil to the greater problem in society today, where people are, you know, in their couches watching Netflix and on their phones all day and then afraid of, you know, just even getting up off the couch or not being plugged into their devices. So just showing kind of the extremes of that. But I think what you're touching on, which David was also touching on with the adrenaline junkie thing, is that technology, even though I'm all for doing painful and hard things as a way to reset reward pathways, technology has allowed us to go so far in that direction that we've essentially turned a good thing into a bad thing. And this is the recurring theme in modern society. We've taken sports, for example, and now we've turned it, unfortunately, into a drug in ever younger people. You know, children now, elementary school sports are now like, there are leaderboards and social media and quantifying people's stats and comparing it to people across the country. Anytime we give a number to something or enumerate it, we release dopamine. Dopamine is very sensitive to enumeration. So even our, I forget what these watches are called, Garmin watches or whatever, you know, Strava, all of that sort of comparing ourselves, enumerating, quantifying, we're now taking something that started out as really good and healthy and potentially turning it into a drug by comparing, by enumerating, by making everything, a competition, by all of the technology that allows us to push ourselves, you know, in more and more extreme circumstances. There's a great series of experiments in mice showing that mice can actually get addicted to running on a running wheel in a cage to the point where they will run themselves to death, to the point where they will run in ever smaller wheels to the extent that their little tails get curved up in the shape of the wheel. If you put a running wheel out in nature where you would think, you know, no mouse would engage in a running wheel in the wonderful wonder world of Mother Nature, it's not true. Even in nature, mice and other animals will run in a running wheel. There's something intrinsically rewarding about that kind of three-dimensional movement experience counter to gravity that stimulates dopamine. It clearly now we see stimulates dopamine. So I think, you know, recognizing the way that even a running wheel is a form of technology, even, the devices in gyms that we have now, those are potential drugs. They've modified a simple experience and drugified it in some way.
My last comment, a friend just was telling me a story about he was mountain biking and he had Strava on and his phone died, which meant that Strava died. And he started to just turn around and go home. And
yeah, right.
Turning his bike around, he went, there is something really wrong with this picture. I got to go on a dopamine fast. So
yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
He said, I'm even embarrassed to tell the story.
Oh, I love it. That's great. I love that. And you know, we're hearing more and more of that, like this sense of really being alienated from our bodies because we're so tuned into these numbers that quantify our bodily experience. It's really fascinating.
The book is Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Dr. Anna Lemke, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. It's such a great conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
All right. Our next guest, Dr. Bob Barali, is a board-certified emergency physician with over 25 years of experience. Dr. Barali transitioned to an integrative medicine clinic specializing in regenerative and Chinese herbal medicine. He's also a fellow at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine. And we're speaking to him today about Journeys. It's his business based in Salt Lake City, which focuses on psychedelic-assisted therapy. They provide expert, comprehensive, and personalized care to their clients, focusing on holistic treatment plans tailored to the individual. Dr. Bob, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm just assuming that that's what your clients call you, Dr. Bob.
They call me Dr. Bob. Some of my friends call me other things, but Dr. Bob's good. It's like a coin toss whether you get the last name right, but you did very well. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Well, you have said that you have dedicated your life to this type of therapy. How so?
Well, like everything, it comes with a story. I did emergency medicine for quite a long time. And what I was finding toward the end of my career, there were more and more unhealthy people on more and more medications, particularly psychiatric medications, and more unhappy people. And within our own field, burnout was skyrocketing. Okay. So, you've got a society that is set up to make mental health issues flourish. And, we're surrounded by these wonderful belief systems with our religions, but we've never taught to how to implement them, okay? We live by rules and we live in fear. And so all that was beginning to weigh on me. Mm-hmm. And, I started to make this transition into integrative medicine with the fellowship, as you mentioned. And over the years, I've done a lot of reading and a lot of work with psychedelic medicine. Just in the background. And, even when I transitioned into integrative health, you would still see a lot of the same patterns. People would show up stressed. That leads to a poor diet, poor sleep, poor lifestyle choices, increased mental health issues. This begets more stress. You just can't sit there as a healthcare provider and draw people a roadmap on what to do. People don't follow that most of the time. And I would ask myself, well, why is that? And you probably have your own reasons why you might not follow a healthcare plan. One, things might work themselves out. Two, you just get used to it. You just get used to the boiling water, so to speak. What I'm interested now is how to use a cliche, how do people change their perspective? And I think either someone who's very introspective and willing to do the work, or someone who's seeing a therapist, like a very gifted therapist and has a good relationship with them, or someone who's maybe doing all of that with the help of psychedelic medicines.
Dr. Bob, like a lot of people, I've grown an interest in this particular topic, using psychedelics for therapy. And there's been a lot of studies and research and documentation of it as of recent. And a good friend of mine has a very severe cancer, and they visited a facility in Salt Lake where they were administered ketamine, and it's done wonders for them. And I'm curious, walk me through the process of what it's like when you come in with any kind of trauma or just introspective search that you're going for. What is the process when you go into your clinic, and how does it work?
Okay, so Dr. Coleman, my business partner, and myself, we have a very different approach than your typical ketamine shop or mill. Okay, so I'm not going to be speaking to the bigger companies out there where you're more or less a number. You're in a sterile environment. It's like a medical procedure. There is none of what I'm talking about, what I led up to. Okay. So this is what would happen. You would come in, and first of all, it's got to be a good fit for you, and it's got to be a good fit for me, you know. And that happens because we create a personalized and safe and comfortable experience for you. We meet several times. You become familiar with the room that you're going to have your ketamine experience in. You have an opportunity to read all sorts of literature that I provide you. You have an opportunity to ask questions. I do mental health assessments. I look at, anxiety, past trauma, just what's your overall mental health like? I do a complete medical examination from an integrative health perspective. It's not a handful of questions and we give you a shot and shut the lights off. Multiple evals, either in person or via Zoom. So now, all right, let's just fast forward, okay? I've answered all of your questions. It's a good fit. You're comfortable with the process. You've done some journaling ahead of time. We've talked about some of your intentions. What do you want to get out of this? Why do you want to try psychedelics? We've talked about this back and forth. Maybe they've evolved. All right, now you come in and see us, okay? You're put in a very comfortable chair or pillows, or you can sit upright if you would like. You get an intramuscular injection based on a lot of factors, okay? But it's weight-based to some extent. To some extent, what's your experience with psychedelics? What's your comfort level going in? Why is all this important? Why is it really important for you to be comfortable and feel safe, all right? And be familiar when you come in? Well, because a lot of times when you're just put in a sterile environment and given a shot, your mind is stuck in this default mode network, this constant surveillance, this fear of what's going on. You might not feel that way, but this is how we walk around from day to day. And if that's the way you're going into this, the medication isn't going to work. You might feel strange. You might just sleep there, okay? You're not going to get this whole experience where you're going to be able to, because I've done all this work that I just mentioned ahead of time to put you at ease so that when you come in there, your parasympathetic nervous system is activated. Your heart rate's in the 50s. You're very relaxed. Okay? And then the ketamine can do its work without your ego behind you trying to control everything and trying to fight the weird feeling that you might have from getting ketamine. And then because of this, you're able to have these insights. You're able to change your perspective, okay? And so that's what, in short, that's what you can expect from our personalized, individualized care. It's Dr. Coleman and myself. We work with various integrative psychotherapists. We find that all this that I just mentioned, all this upfront work is equally as important as the actual drug ketamine, which is a little bit different discussion.
I would imagine the regulations within not only the country, but the state of Utah are really arduous. And what is the process to become certified to administer not only psychedelics, but ketamine in general?
Well, ketamine's been used for a variety of things in America. For example, I don't want to go back to the history. It's been around since the Vietnam era, but classically for general anesthesia, pain syndromes, calming a violent patient in the emergency department. Those are just a few examples. Okay, the minimum requirements would be someone who's familiar with the use of ketamine and has had to administer it. Now, is there a training that you go through? Well, personally, I did a four-year residency where I use ketamine almost every day. Most of my career, I used it almost every day for sure, sometimes twice a day. There's constant continuing medical education. We have to pass examinations. I did rotations through anesthesiology. I've got to have a DEA license in order to prescribe ketamine. That's no easy feat. And then, you know, I've got advanced airway support training, you know, in case something bad happens, which, you know, to speak to ketamine, it's probably one of the safest medications ever mm-hmm. created. It's almost a miracle. It's been something that emergency physicians in particular love using. It's like the first line drug that we go to in the emergency department when needed.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Dr. Robert Burali.
Yes.
His business is myjourneys.com. You can find it. It's journeys, J-O-U-R-N-E-A-S-E. So myjourneys.com. That's where you can go. And a really comprehensive website, really explaining the ins and outs of this. I think many people are very curious about this type of therapy, but I'm wondering how much what went on in, you know, the great, what was it called? The great acid test of, you know, the 60s and 70s. It was more experimental back then. And I think it left maybe a bad taste for the real positive types of therapy that you're doing now and that is becoming more and more mainstream. Can you just comment briefly on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the best time to be alive because what we have now is more of a comfort with some of these, I don't even know what the term is, Eastern perspectives, alternative perspectives, indigenous perspectives. Psychedelics have been around for a long time. So you've got that perspective melding with the Western philosophy of science. You know, how do these medicines work? Proof, validity. Can you repeat this? Can we have one size fit all? Can we take the magic out of the psychedelics and make it so people just take a ketamine pill every day for the rest of their lives? Okay, so somewhere in the middle, okay, is where the excitement lies. I obviously don't adhere to taking a pill for the rest of your life, but there are people busy at work doing research on this, and they're not doing research out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing research because they want to patent new versions of ayahuasca, LSD, ketamine, psilocybin, which are in magic mushrooms. To just go back to the past, though, and answer your question, boy, can you imagine running around in the 60s and someone trips up upon magic mushrooms or LSD, and you've got these new insights that are answering a lot of questions, but you have no perspective. All right. Now, all of a sudden, you're telling your friends to start taking LSD. You know, if you're just taking LSD in a vacuum, or to back up a bit, in a place where you don't feel entirely safe, you know, you're at a rock concert, you're driving around on a school bus, you know, you're at a dead show, you're standing on a street corner and you're on LSD. What do you think's happening?
Yeah.
Your mind is trying to make sense of this. And for a lot of people, the experience goes south. So you had a handful of those cases on the news, and all of a sudden the powers that be said, we should put all these medications away. We've had a couple bad apples. Instead of letting, back to Western science, do some work on this, you know, and instead of, in typical, I'm not going to say American fashion, but you know, you throw the baby out with the bathwater. Right. First time I said that on public radio.
Well, yeah. So that is why on your website, you very, very clearly say we do not endorse the procurement of these substances to take just recreationally. What you are doing is a very curated, very monitored. I don't know exactly. I've heard it called like a trip guide before, but you walk along through the entire session and then some. There's an aftermath as well. That could you explain what you do after someone comes down off the medication, off the ketamine?
Sure. There's a possibility that if we were all wandering around in the wilderness and took a psychedelic, we would have some insights. Okay. But boy, wouldn't it be nice to have someone there to help you put these things into perspective? Like, what happens if you just saw some really dark things about yourself, about your future, something that you couldn't even put words to, but you had someone there to facilitate you? I mean, this isn't some new wacky thing we created in America. This is what people have been doing for generations, okay, in different cultures. But we call it a drug coach or a facilitator, okay? So people go through our, they journey with us. It lasts maybe 50 minutes. A lot of this is depending upon the route of administration, which I can discuss if you want. Anyhow, say they get an intramuscular shot of ketamine, and we put these mind folds on them. They're like blindfolds that you can open your eyes under. Play this music through these headphones. They might be referred to as silent disco headphones. The music is something that's unearthly. It's something you've never heard before. It's not Jackson Brown. It doesn't have lyrics. And so they come out of this on the back end and they talk about their experience. And I write all that down. And they might want to sit there and write it down. And it might be immediately. It might be the next day. It might be 5 days from now. It might be a month from now. But there's this continued growth. We create this container of safety where they can do that. But then they have to go home. Now what? We've got psychedelic integration specialists that help to make sense of these things. Okay. And it's personalized. You know, I could just give you something like a basic example. Someone has issues with control in their life. They're getting in the way of them doing anything productive. It's destroying relationships. It's leading to anxiety and all these other health pillars and integrative health that I was talking to you about. Diet, sleep, exercise, lifestyle choices. Because they've got these control issues, nobody's happy around them. One of their intentions way back when was to help with this. They come on the outside of this and maybe they've had some growth in this area. Everyone feels good. How does that growth change, you know, it go into behaviors? How do behaviors stick? This is what happens in the aftermath. It is not just a sterile office, a shot, and someone takes you home and let me know how it works out someday if I bump into you. It's comprehensive. It's personalized. Again, it's more about the quality. I don't need to do 100 patients. I need a few people that grow and continue to grow. I'm interested in behavior, not feeling good afterwards. Everyone feels great. They never want to leave. Okay.
And Dr. Bob, how long is the experience? How long does it last? One, and two, How many visits does a typical patient come to you guys for?
It's a good question. The intramuscular now, okay? Different from IV, different from intranasal, up your nose, different from sublingual, under your tongue. Intramuscular, 50 minutes, hour and a half at most. And you would wake from that because it's intramuscular and it, you know, bypasses your liver. It's in and out of your system in a relatively short period of time. You wake up from that and you feel relatively normal. You know, you're not falling all over the place usually. Okay. And we recommend, you know, 4 to 6, journeys, maybe separated by 1 to 2 weeks. We definitely don't like to do 2 a week. You know, my experience has been people continue to have insights and growth long after, you know, in ways that they can't even imagine. And someone who's particularly attuned to this will write about these things and write about how they want them to be a part of their life and growth. And they will say that, you know, long after the fact, months later, they still have insights, revelations, and opportunities for growth. I'm interested in the growth part of it.
I would imagine comes at a cost. And so do individuals pay per class or per class, per session, or can they buy a booklet of 4 to 6? And what is the cost, if you don't mind sharing that?
I don't mind, you know, and again, there's different opportunities here. Okay. So, you know, say you just want to ask me questions for 20 minutes. It's not like I'm twiddling my thumbs, wondering what to do with the day. That's a $50 meet and greet session. You're just curious. The medical evaluation is $350. Psychiatric, integrative health, that's an hour. You've never been asked more questions in your life. You come out of that ready for a nap. We do a prep session beforehand, and that's a one-time thing. That's on the days leading up to your journey. This is when we talk again about what are your intentions? Are you ready for this? Things to do before game day, things to work on your parasympathetic nervous system. Are you journaling? Are you meditating? What are you eating? Are you limiting alcohol and substances in general? Are you going to, do you have chores to do after this journey? Are you thinking about the rest of your day? You know, just get people in that right headspace. And so, and all that's mentioned are a way to become more familiar with me or Dr. Coleman, you know, or the process. Maybe the prep session is you actually coming in and seeing where you're going to be. Can you imagine what that feels like? You've got this familiarity. This isn't you at a rock concert wondering when this trip is going to end. Okay. Right. This is, you know, so, I'm sorry. So then, you know, it depends. So the sessions can be, you know, $600 or $700 a session, the actual journeying sessions. If you want to integrate after the fact, and I insist on this actually with an integration specialist, you know, who is very familiar with the psychedelic landscape, that can be $150 to $200 per session. I mean, you know, the hopes is that, you know, it's expensive up front, you know, but like afterwards, a lot of this stuff is free. I mean, if you just sit and read a few chapters in an integrative health textbook, this is all stuff that you can't even monetize. These are all fundamentals. What is important?
We're speaking with Bob Barali about journeys. It's psychedelic therapy, ketamine therapy specifically, psychedelic integration. We know that this works in cases of PTSD, with addiction, with, it's funny that you mentioned this control thing. So it really works for people that are dealing with a real variety of situations. But I think a lot of the media and the focus is on specifically like PTSD, depression, addiction. How would you add to that? And who does it not work for? Who do you at the end of your interview say, you know what, ketamine therapy is not for you?
Great questions. Okay. So, you know, how did ketamine become something that is used in the mental health space? For most of my career, that wasn't even a discussion. If you had told me that ketamine was a drug of abuse, that people are just hanging out in bars using this stuff, I would be like, you're crazy. Anyone I've ever given ketamine to, they just go to sleep and then they wake up and after I've done my procedure, sewing up a laceration, putting in a dislocated hip, et cetera, you know. But, you know, all of a sudden, somehow people were getting this medication and they maybe reported less depressive symptoms. The drug companies figured out, well, ketamine is $2 a bottle. Maybe we can, you know, use the S enantiomer or the R enantiomer, which are, you know, mirror images of what this drug looks like in solution. Maybe we can pull one of these out and see if it works on people with treatment-resistant depression, whatever that means, okay? Like, what does that actually mean? You know, what's the treatment? For how long? Who is this in? And somehow, you know, if you look at what needs to happen for a new drug to come to market, it's got to be better than placebo. It's got to be as good as the standard of care, you know, antidepressants, you know, and it may be less side effects. So now all of a sudden it's $1,000 nasal spray that may or may not work. Okay. And this is just in a vacuum. You're getting a spray you're not getting everything I've just discussed with you. That is cost prohibitive, quite frankly. Okay. And the drug companies would want you to just be on this, you know, indefinitely for $1,000 a month. Great. It's a win-win for them and not so much for the patients. So how I would add to that is that there are a lot of other off-label treatments with ketamine, OCD, you know, maybe not major treatment-resistant depression, but the typical depressive symptoms that we see, generalized anxiety disorder, PTSD, okay? You know, that's where I see this going. Mm-hmm. Who isn't this right for? Okay, so there's some contraindications that are theoretical. You know, there's the obvious health ones. Do you have a heart condition? You know, are you prone to seizure disorder? Theoretically, can lower your seizure threshold. You know, pregnant, you know, people with psychosis, people with a family history of psychosis. When I mean psychosis, I'm talking about schizophrenia. You know, but what I'm looking for is someone that has the bandwidth to learn. I really hate that term. But someone that's got an understanding of everything that we just discussed here, or at least is coachable, you know, and wants to really work with me. That's what I'm looking for. If you're not that, then you're not suitable for this.
Right.
I think nobody's going to be happy, you know, like, and to me, the two of us have to be happy going in. So.
Dr. Bob Barali, Dr. Robert Barali. I have a feeling we could speak to you all morning, but we are out of time. So we're going to wrap this up. If you're interested in learning more, you go to myjourneys.com. It's myjourneas.com. We'll also put that on our website and on our podcast. Dr. Bob, it's been a real pleasure getting to know you. And I didn't even mention that you're also a Park City resident. So even though this business is based in Salt Lake.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
Bye now.